What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The Scott administration says Vermont is one of the leading states in the country when it comes to overall vaccination rates, a situation that has led to a lower number of weekly cases. However, the rates for younger people are lower than hoped for, and the state has put a number of initiatives in place to improve this. About 6 weeks ago, Black, Indigenous, and people of color and new American Vermonters became eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine, and initially the response rate lagged behind the state average. Today in the program, we're going to look at a number of local community efforts to boost the BIPOC vaccination rate and how the success of these programs might serve as a model to improve racial equity in other parts of our healthcare system. And joining us right now is VPR's digital editor and reporter, Abigail Giles. Abigail, great to have you on the program.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here.
So, Abigail, by early April, BIPOC Vermonters lagged 13% behind white Vermonters. That gap has since closed by nearly half. It's continuing to narrow. You've had a chance to take a look at this situation. How did it happen, and what's happening now?
Well, I think you really started to see that gap close as more community-specific clinics were hosted across the state. So these are clinics designed by and for BIPOC Vermonters, really led and envisioned by Vermonters who are people of color. And they ran with funding and support, and in some cases, staffing from the Vermont Department of Health. So according to health department data, almost 6,000 people have been vaccinated through BIPOC and ELL vaccination clinics since February. And about 17 community partners have helped design and run these clinics. The Vermont Professionals of Color Network are here with us today, but also groups like the Association of Africans Living in Vermont, the Black Perspective, the Vermont Racial Justice Alliance, and the NAACP, to name a few.
So, Abigail, you mentioned the clinic strategy that was adopted. Why was that the strategy that was used as opposed to directing folks to some of the state-run vaccination sites or the pharmacies offering these vaccines?
Yeah, so often when we talk about a certain group of people that isn't getting vaccinated, sometimes there's an assumption that it's due to hesitancy about the vaccine itself or misinformation. And for some people in some communities across the state, I think that may be so. But I think it's also important to realize, too, that in Vermont, we have a history of institutionalized racism in medicine. The eugenics movement locally targeted Black, Abenaki, and other members of our community under the guise of offering medical care. And collecting medical information was part of that process. So when your family or your community has been harmed by an institution in that way, you don't forget. And so for some people I spoke with, there was a distrust of public health or personal experiences with racism in clinical settings that made people not so enthused about state-run or pharmacy-run clinics. I spoke with one Vermonter, Maroney Mintner of Waterbury, about one way that the BIPOC clinic he went to in Burlington tried to address this with the registration form, that they used for people signing up to get vaccines.
Some of us don't really want to share our personal information about our pre-existing conditions and all of these personal information that the Vermont Department of Health is asking on these forms. The form that the BIPOC clinic created to kind of avoid asking all these personal questions that people don't want to talk about.
Yeah, and I asked Maroney, was the history of racism in healthcare what was causing some of that apprehension that he spoke to? And he said yes, that it was. And yet it's actually something that many medical providers aren't fully aware of. I also spoke with Dr. Maria Mercedes Avila at the University of Vermont, and she's a professor at the Larner School of Medicine who studies racism in healthcare. And her research shows that nationwide, as many as 75% of medical providers don't know the full history of racial disparities or systemic racism in healthcare. And she said, you know, you can't unpack your own bias if you don't know the history.
So that lack of knowledge is directly impacting the way providers are able to interact or not with historically underserved communities in our area.
That was Dr. Avila. And at the Burlington BIPOC clinics, the first face people see when they come to get their shot is a community member who looks like them, sometimes maybe someone that they know. The clinic locations actually weren't advertised at first to keep organizers and participants safe. That's since changed, but staff also personalize care and, you know, follow up with vaccine recipients and, you know, seek referrals, offer to drive neighbors. So it's really kind of a sort of comprehensive approach.
Well, joining us right now to give us the perspective of being on the ground at these clinics are Luis Calderon, who is the founder and chief creative strategist for OKOK Marketing and Creative, and Blaine Antise, who is a public policy research analyst for the City of Burlington's Racial Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging Office. They're both board members of the Vermont Professionals of Color Network, which manages the Vermont Health Equity Initiative. And some news today, the initiative announced it's committed to providing vaccination clinics to BIPOC Vermonters and their households through July 10th. Luis and Blaine, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Hey, Bob. Thank you for having us. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Luis, let me start with you. As you started thinking about putting this project together, was sort of one of the important starting points that what the state was doing in its state-run vaccination clinics just wasn't going to work in these communities?
Well, Bob, the history of it with the way COVID was handled from the beginning, you know, was concerning at a national level for these communities, and especially in our communities of color across the state. When we looked at the history of even testing, there were all types of ways it was mismanaged and put these communities at greater risk. So it was that part of the COVID-19 rollout that alarmed us and, you know, made it necessary for us to center those experiences at the top of in front of our minds for vaccination. That's why we fought so hard to prioritize vaccination for these communities.
And so how did you go about designing the experience in a way that made people feel safe and comfortable?
Well, it's been a collaborative effort from the very beginning with a number of local organizations and state organizations, all centered around focusing on communities of color. And so it's what we did from the very onset was sort of identify what seemed to be best practices. And, you know, we went from trying to find ways to minimize complications around registrations. We know that there are sensitivities at registration. There are barriers of entry with the registration. So we did everything we could to make it an easy process. Then scheduling has been a very, you know, sort of case management approach to facilitating individuals' needs. Then when they come to the facility itself, they're greeted by folks that look like them. We are very warm. We make it a point to you know, celebrate the fact that they're there with us at that particular point. The check-in process is fast and easy. And I want to shout out our third partner on this work, Weiwei Wang, that has been leading the scheduling and check-in process. And then the clinic itself has been, you know, well run by our partners. At one point, the National Guard, now UVMMC.
A lot of activity wherever you are, Luis. Blaine, let me ask you, Luis was telling us that a community-based approach was really needed because of some people's distrust of the government, and that that distrust ran pretty deep for very good reasons. What do you think was the key to making folks feel safe in this setting?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's two things here. There is the distrust in the government and institutions that do this work, whether it's the Department of Health or other medical institutions. And we have this conversation now with racism as a public health emergency, which tries to address some of that at the state and the city level of Burlington, as well as this conversation now around a formal apology on eugenics. So that history is already there among many different pieces of history. I think the other thing, this apprehension, is we focus a lot on fear or apprehension or vaccine aversion. And I think more the question is vaccine inaccessibility. So to get to these clinics, to take time off of work, to be able to communicate in the language that you're most comfortable in, to get all the information you need to make the decision. So one of the things that our clinics are focusing on is to reduce vaccine inaccessibility, whether it's with transportation or interpretation or education sessions, follow-up, comfort, and everything that we're seeing is that is helping a lot. So as we talk about vaccine aversion and fear around the vaccine because of institutional harm, we also want to talk about inaccessibility, which is also a form of systemic racism.
And Blaine, we've learned that BIPOC Vermonters over 65 have a lower than average vaccination rate. Why do you think that's the case?
I mean, a bunch of different reasons, I'm sure. I would point to a few things. Is Vermont is one of the whitest states, and as we get younger in demographics, it becomes more diverse. But our 65 plus age group, there are plenty 65 plus BIPOC people, but there are fewer and far between. So accessibility there, but as well as I imagine that our older BIPOC community members are the ones who remember the harm the most that has happened most severely in the past. And we want to make sure that they get everything they need to feel comfortable with this. And then I guess just across the board is we have a skewed younger demographic. We also know that life expectancy for older BIPOC Vermonters is lower than that for white Vermonters too. So I think that plays into the numbers here.
So are you putting together some special programs or some special efforts for these older folks to address the concerns that you just mentioned?
Yeah, thank you. We see the gap in 65 plus. We also see the gap in our younger demographic of kind of the 19 to 30 year olds. So both of those we're trying to tackle. The Vermont Professionals of Color Network, we try to be a multi-generational network in that we have everyone from an early professional to a very seasoned tenured professional. And we start with that. And we also, I think one of the things I'd mention as well is some of our older BIPOC residents of Burlington and of Vermont are ones who had immigrated here early on. So the interpretation efforts are to support them as well, to make sure that they have all the language access supports that they need to feel comfortable at our clinic.
Abigail, let me bring you back into this conversation. So far, this has been a very Burlington-focused conversation. But your reporting also took you to southern Vermont, where the NAACP of Windham County has been organizing vaccine clinics. These clinics have since wrapped up. What have we learned about that experience?
Bob, I did. I spoke with Wichi Artu, who's vice president of the Windham County NAACP. And they say the partnerships formed during the pandemic between community groups and the health department could offer a sort of a roadmap, if you will, for starting to dismantle some of the other institutional racism in Vermont, both
by
in
being able to have partnered with us and being able to actually pay us for this work. We were able to access those vulnerable populations. And moving forward, it's important that because we're on the ground, we know what the issues are. The Department of Health, and I think they realize this, that, you know, the Department of Health needs to do the work in conjunction with those who know the people. And us as community organizations, we know the people.
Blaine and Luis, let me bring you back into this conversation. Blaine, I'd love to get your thoughts on this bigger picture questions of whether or not the clinics that are operating now might provide or at least begin to provide a greater roadmap for racial equity in healthcare.
Well, Bob, yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. We suddenly found ourselves as a professional network doing clinics with all of our amazing partners, following in the footsteps of AALV and the LEP clinics, as well as the clinics done by Windham County and NAACP. So in that, we're trying to push forward all together to make sure that there is a roadmap. And part of that is now a section of our Professionals of Color Network will be called the Vermont Health Equity Initiative, which we've launched today, actually. And you can find information at www.vermonthealthequity.org. And that has all the information on this initiative, on the clinics, how to register, some education sessions we're setting up, and that will grow over time. But I think the thing, to answer your question, is one of the lessons we've learned and one of the outcomes of this partnership that we've had with the multiple institutions that have supported this effort is we're creating, hopefully, a model to have BIPOC not only have a seat at the table, but BIPOC organizations having the head of the table and leading this effort for our communities. And one example is how we've engaged with VDH and the other institutions here. And then the other part of your question is the Vermont Health Equity Initiative is starting with these clinics and will not stop there. I know that the vaccine conversation will evolve over time, and this public health crisis will, with the pandemic, will be here for a while, but with racism will be here, I'm sure, for the rest of my life and beyond. So we are trying to make sure that we're setting up the relationships and the infrastructure and the resources and the BIPOC leadership to make sure that from here on out, BIPOC people are recovering from this economic crisis, from this health crisis, and that we can tackle all the systemic issues that we've seen and make it better for the future. So that is the whole goal with Vermont Health Equity Initiative. Again, we're excited to have people on board. Definitely visit at the website, and we'll see you there.
And we'll have that website information available at vpr.org as well for any folks that would be very interested in getting that information. Luis, what about this bigger picture question of whether or not these clinics provide a roadmap? What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I think that we're at a point in the state's history where we are being honest with it's how it has operated, how it has served these communities, and giving the wheel over to organizations like ours to drive forward and to be and seeing us be successful. I feel confident in that with the leadership of the various organizations we've been working with, that they are championing this type of programming moving forward. But there is something about how often we forget how often institutions forget their role in institutional racism and their role in systemic racism being very different, and thirdly, individual racism. So there is a lot of education that is constantly needed all across the way, and we are here to remind people of those issues, but we are also here to continue to move us forward in a positive, equitable, and healthy manner for all Vermonters. I will also say that the days of thinking of BIPOC Vermonters as an afterthought should be considered over. There are 40,000 BIPOC Vermonters, all of which are taxpayers, all of which are voters, that if once mobilized, become very, very powerful in this state. And that is also our intention, to make sure that people understand that this is their right, that we do not need to be begging to be recognized, that this is our right as citizens of the state, and we demand to be top of mind. And so I think all of these things together in partnership with leadership across the state, and I will applaud our senior, you know, leadership, they did recognize this as an opportunity to show the rest of the country what it looks like when organizations come together, citizens come together, and put resources, actions behind their words. And we, as we often have led the way nationally with these sort of efforts, and the other communities are starting to model off of as a result.
Well, joining us right now is Vermont's Deputy Health Commissioner, Tracy Dolan. Tracy, welcome back to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you.
Thank
you. Do we still have you there, Tracy? I'm not sure. Tracy, hopefully you're still here. Well, we'll do our very best to get some technical connections to Tracy and learn about the health department's involvement in this program. Abigail, let me come back to you. Before we let you go, there is a bill moving through the legislature that would establish a new Office of Health Equity. That office would be responsible for studying health disparities in Vermont and expand public health programs within communities. What's the status of that?
Yeah, so that's a bill, H210. It was passed by the House and Senate last week. And the one thing I would just add about this is that not only would it be focused on the needs of Vermonters who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color, but also those with disabilities or who are LGBTQ+. So I think there's some kind of new opportunity there. And I, you know, hopefully Deputy Commissioner Dolan will come back on. There's also some funding available to support new initiatives and kind of partnerships like what we saw, you know, Louise and Blaine described moving forward. So definitely some opportunities for the work to continue and be funded in the future.
Well, I'm happy to say that our crack engineering crew has got Tracy Dolan back on the line. Tracy, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much. And I wanted to say hello to Louise and Blaine. We were actually just meeting this morning, and it's nice to be with them again as well.
So, Tracy, tell us, what has the department learned from its partnerships with these community organizations this year?
You know, it's been a great year. We actually have a long history of some partnerships with communities of color in Vermont, but this year has been different in that it's been more intense. We've had, in terms of the intensity of activity, the ability to put more resources into it, and the expansion of the number of partners. We've never had this many partnerships active at this kind of time in such a visible way. In the same way that this pandemic has put public health front and center on the stage, I feel like it's really also at the same time raised the visibility of where we have inequities in health. We see it with rural, urban, we see it in age groups, and in this case, we've really particularly seen it with Black, Indigenous, and people of color. We see real differences, of course, early on with the rates of COVID infection. Vermont lagged a little on that. We saw it pick up nationally, and then we saw it here within Vermont. And then, you know, with our vaccine rates. And so it's been an incredible year. And I would say one of the big learnings with the new organizations and with the existing organizations is, you know, you kind of learn the same lessons over and over again, and hopefully you learn them better. But just the importance of partnership, the importance of being able to listen to each other, develop common goals, and the importance of, for us internally, to be ready to understand how to do a partnership and to be able to really share that leadership role and to sit back and really learn from the lived experience all over the state and in our communities.
Tracy, do you see these partnerships as a way of beginning to address racial inequities in our healthcare system?
Absolutely, yeah. And some of those partnerships have been doing that for a little while, and it continues to build on that. Understanding the inequities in our system, you know, I would say we have a pretty good understanding. Health equity has been a focus in public health nationally, probably for the last 5 to 10 years in a very intentional way. I think what we're needing to move beyond, and this pandemic, you know, sadly, in some ways, has given us the opportunity to do that, is to move from understanding to really driving into action, implementation, innovation? What are the strategies? What are the systems that we need to change? I feel like there's understanding. There can always be more understanding, but then really turning that understanding into action and intention and strategy.
I want our listeners to know that Abigail's full feature will run this afternoon on All Things Considered. Abigail, great, great job. Thanks very much for reporting on this very important issue.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It was great to be here with everyone.
And Blaine, if folks are interested in learning more information about your work and the Vermont Health Equity Initiative, what's the best thing for them to do?
I think the best thing for them to do is to go to vermonthealthequity.org, and we'll have all the information there.
Luis and Blaine, thank you very much for being on the program today and discussing this very important issue with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob, Abigail, Tracy. Thank you all for having us.
Be well, friends.
Tracy, you know, we hear lots of reasons of why folks, let's say under 30, may not be getting vaccinated. Do you think I think young people sometimes think of themselves as being very healthy and invincible. Do you think that's a major factor?
You know, we don't have research right now on all the reasons that the young people are not getting vaccinated, but research from other kinds of health behaviors would tell us that that's likely one reason that young people generally tend not to do preventive health practices is often because the idea of becoming sick or ill or even dying feels very far away. So it is that invincibility. But we also think some of it might be simply just didn't get around to it yet. And some of it also might be the way we've set up our vaccine clinics. You know, for a lot of them, you need to go online and register. And a lot of young people are living in a much more immediate world where you kind of show up or you send a quick text and you get what you need. And so that's one of the reasons we're shifting to a lot more of the walk-in clinic approach, so that people can actually show up and walk in without an appointment. And you'll see a lot more of those opening up. They've already been open for a couple of weeks in some locations. And we're also trying to bring the vaccine to them. And we would do that really for any community that's not providing uptake in the way that we like. And so, bringing it to the colleges, for example, so the colleges are running clinics, making sure that it's in some of the more populated areas where young people gather. So that's called a place-based approach. So we're trying to do that, make it easy, and just doing everything we can and then trying to get a lot more information out there so we can really highlight all the benefits, in addition to the health benefits, just the freedom of movement, being able to gather with friends and all of those benefits.
Luis and Blaine talked about making sure that people had access to the vaccine. It sounds like that's a strategy that you're using with younger Vermonters as well.
Absolutely. We're using it with younger Vermonters. We're also using it in areas where we've had lower vaccine uptake. Essex was one example. We showed up and we just put clinics, all over Essex, roll up an ambulance crew in an area, give people some notice so they could just come right out nearby and get vaccinated. But we're also doing that with younger people. It's one good way. We're going to keep being innovative and trying to think about ways to get at that group that isn't necessarily afraid of vaccine, but more just not quite there yet in terms of accessing or planning it.
So if you have this kind of spur-of-the-moment decision that young people are making to be vaccinated, particularly with the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, how do you ensure that they do the follow-up several weeks later?
We have really, really good. Actually, in the nation, we're among the top in follow-up for second dose. So we've been doing well on that. But it is one of the reasons that J&J is really useful for this population. Young people tend to be a little more transient. Maybe they're here now, but they're leaving for the summer, or maybe they were here for college. And their housing tends to be a little less secure, right? So they might be in a place for a few months, but not necessarily living in a house long-term or in one neighborhood. So J&J is another nice option for that. Unfortunately, we don't always have enough of the vaccine we want. As Dr. Fauci reminds us, the best vaccine is the one that's available. So that's another option for people.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to Kathleen, who's calling from East Haven. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. As you know, my question is about what do the highest ranking experts say about the safety of the Pfizer vaccine? And Dr. Michael Yaden, former vice president and chief medical and respiratory scientist of Pfizer, has stated that the normal and acceptable standards for the development of a vaccine have been completely abandoned with the vaccines for COVID-19. And in a speech in this year, I quote, he said, "It's wholly unethical to administer something novel and for which the potential for unwanted effects after a few months is completely uncharacterized. In no other era would it be wise to do what is stated as the intention. Since I know this with certainty and I know those driving it know this too, we have to inquire, what is their motive? It is also intended that minor children and eventually babies are to be included in the net, and that's what I interpret to be an evil act." Unquote. Dr. Yaden's comments would indicate that there is an unprecedented risk involved in getting this vaccine. There are many experts around the world that are also crying out about this vaccine, yet they are suppressed and censored. Why black out all debate in the land of the free? I'll take my
Well, Kathleen, let's give Deputy Commissioner Dolan an opportunity to answer that. Tracy, I have to believe that you've come across a fair number of people in Vermont who raise the same kind of safety questions that Kathleen is raising. How do you respond to them?
Yes, and certainly there are safety questions that have been raised. I would respond that the research and the trials on this have been thorough. While it feels fast, normally in vaccine research, you may only have one company or one part of the world working on vaccine development. In this case, because we're in pandemic mode, the intensity of the research is such that we have safety trials going on all over the world. There's been an incredible amount of focus on this. So pharmaceutical companies that may have been working on something else have put that aside to work on this. We are very confident in the safety. The preponderance, vast majority of experts across the board in healthcare, in biomedical industries are very clear on this. And the CDC, who really guides us, has full confidence in this. In particular, with this vaccine, the effectiveness has been incredibly high among children. In this latest trial, which is the trial that is being used as the source to get us to the place of hopefully approving today from CDC, the Pfizer vaccine for 12 and up. In the control group, I believe it was 18 of the children got COVID-19. None of the children in the group that got the Pfizer vaccine got COVID-19. What we do know is that COVID-19 can be very dangerous for people. It can go anywhere from no symptoms to mild illness to very ill hospitalization all the way to death, as we've seen, of course, sadly, in Vermont. And so that's what we know about the real risk of COVID. What we know about the risk of the vaccine is that it is very low. It has been tested on thousands upon thousands of people. And in fact, it is probably the most thoroughly researched to this point and monitored vaccine anywhere in the world. The amount of scrutiny is incredible because it is going to go out to so many people. So we are confident in what we're hearing. And as you saw, if there are any questions, CDC clearly flags them. They briefly paused J&J over safety concerns. So we feel confident in the process.
Let's talk to Allison, who is calling from Danville. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for being here for questions. So my background is in preventative public health, and because of this, I'm very familiar with the PCR test and its limitations. And I was speaking to the chief medical officer of my local hospital and was very concerned when he was referring to the PCR test as a gold standard test specific for COVID. And a PCR test, by definition, is a surrogate test. It's not a gold standard test. It never could be. And stated the CDC in the PCR instruction manual as well, they state, and also in the lab requisition forms, that the test cannot rule out other viral or bacterial infections. So with this in mind, coupled with the fact that a PCR test is based on an amplification rate or cycle threshold, which essentially refers to multiplication of a specimen, my two questions are this. If a PCR test has a cycle threshold of approximately 35 to 40 or above, there'll be an 80 to 90% false positive rate. On the other end, if the cycle threshold is too low, there'll be a high percentage of false positives. This is how PCR testing works. So the CDC just came out recently because of the, you know, quote-unquote breakthrough cases that we're seeing with vaccinated individuals, which clearly indicates either a problem with the vaccine or the PCR test. So because of the breakthrough cases, the CDC has recommended reducing the cycle threshold for vaccinated individuals to 28, which will falsely create a divide between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals in positive cases. So my question is two-part. Is there a standard cycle threshold for the PCR test currently being used across the board in Vermont? And is Vermont currently now or considering in the future reducing the cycle threshold for vaccinated individuals, which will create a false division in positive cases between the two groups?
Okay, Allison, thank you for your question. Tracy, maybe we could just start off by reminding listeners what the PCR test is.
Sure. The PCR test is the test that you take in order to determine whether or not you're positive for COVID. It is the one that we most commonly use here in Vermont. There are other tests, antigen tests, but the PCR test, for the most part, has been our standard test. And what the listener is talking about, cycle threshold, is this idea that there are amplification cycles in order to, it's almost like a magnifying glass. If you put a magnifying glass closer and closer and closer, how close do you need to get it in order to see what your result is? And the cycle threshold, there's been a lot of discussion about this, so this isn't the first time we've heard about it. And CDC's been looking closely at this. It is true that the higher the cycle threshold, the more likely you are to find even a small amount of virus. And the question is, well, with even a small amount of virus, is that enough to make anyone sick? Therefore, how useful is it to call out a positive? We do go by CDC guidance on this and the guidance from our National Laboratory Association. And again, I can't speak to the most recent CDC announcement and whether or not they've changed their standard. I can't speak to that. But certainly up until a few weeks ago, we were continuing to go by the CDC guidance, which is the higher cycle threshold of between 35 and 40, which means that when you're tested, we may occasionally pick up a positive that that could be determined as a false positive. That wouldn't be common. The research shows that still most of the positives are true positives, but it could be possible that we're picking up a disease where perhaps a person doesn't have enough virus either to be ill or to even pass it on. But that is not the most common. We are erring on the side of caution. We've had our own infectious disease experts here in Vermont review this question based on some of the research and based on some of the questions your caller identified. But we will go back and look to see if CDC is changing its official guidance. Usually they would put that out as an advisory to all health departments and advise on a change in methodology. And we would certainly look at that and determine if that makes sense. Whether or not it creates a divide, we're less concerned about that. We're in the here and now moving forward. But there are going to be breakthrough cases. While it's possible those could be related to a PCR test, what's more possible is that we know the vaccine is very effective, but not 100% effective. So occasionally people will be vaccinated and will still get COVID-19. And so regardless of the kind of test, we recognize that occasionally people still will, because there's probably no vaccine that is 100% effective on every single individual.
Tracy, you mentioned that a vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds will likely be approved today, I believe, by the CDC. How soon would this vaccine be available to young people in Vermont, and how are you going to try to kind of target that age group?
That's a great question. No, we're very excited. Our chief of immunization right now is in a call with CDC, so we're hoping to hear today. When the FDA approves a drug, they approve it based on safety and effectiveness, and then it goes to the CDC where they take a look at it from a clinical perspective and then translate that into clinical guidance. So they get specific about the age and also, for example, in a two-dose vaccine, the amount of time between first dose and second dose and any other clinical guidance that they might need to give. We anticipate that they will likely
announced today. If they do, our registration would be open the next day. And so if they announce tonight, you should be able to go online tomorrow. And in any of our clinics, our state-run clinics online, you should be able to register for your kids who are 12 and over. You will likely also see this rolling out in all the pharmacies as well. So it could be as soon as tomorrow. And that would be all of our existing clinics. We're also doing a lot of other things. Again, this is a population of 27,000 additional people. We'd love to vaccinate them all. We recognize not all may get the vaccine, but we're going to do everything we can to get opportunities there. We're going to open up some clinics in some school buildings. Those will be public clinics available to everyone, but really targeted at some of these younger people. We'll also add clinics possibly throughout the week and in additional parts of the state in order to be able to accommodate what we hope are big numbers.
So you see schools as being a potential place where some of the younger people can be vaccinated?
Yes, yeah. We would use, in partnership with the Agency of Education, and they'll have more details on that, we would set up in some schools, not all schools, we'd set up in some schools so that kids might be able to more easily get vaccinated there, and then others could also sign up and go to that location.
Tracy, let me ask you a question that people have asked me, and I have no idea what the answer is, so I'm hoping you can enlighten us. You know, it seems as you talk to folks who have had the vaccination, despite their age or any other health conditions, it seems like some people have no reaction whatsoever. You know, they just breeze right through it. They hardly feel a thing. Then you have other folks who say, God, I was really tired after the first shot or really fatigued after the second shot. And then you have some people who say, whoa, I got knocked sideways. I really needed to stay home for a day. How can there be such a different reaction to this vaccine among all these individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, our bodies are all different. We all respond differently to getting a flu or even a cold. Some people have a cold, they keep going to work, they're over it in 3 days. Other of us get a cold and we're knocked out for 5 days. So we all have different immune responses to all kinds of situations. Sometimes it's connected to age, although you might have people of the same age and even have the same health status having very different reactions. So it's just unique to your body, to your immune response, to other things that might be going on with you at that time, to other underlying conditions you may have. But what isn't different is the vaccine. That's the same dose for everyone. So really, it just is about different body chemistry and different health status that might create a different response.
And Tracy, you've talked about the state's effort of, especially now, going out and meeting people where they are and providing and having access to the vaccines. What about all those Vermonters who are really homebound? What has been the state's efforts there?
We started a homebound program a few months ago now. We partnered with local organizations that work with homebound Vermonters, and our fantastic EMS partners have been going out to homebound. The bulk of that was done early on. We partnered with visiting nurse associations, looked at their client list. We talked to hospitals to see who they had who were homebound. And in the meantime, we also had a phone number that was available on our website for anyone we might be missing. So we still do some homebound, but we really have captured a lot. But if anyone is homebound in that they can't get to a healthcare provider, and their healthcare normally comes to them, and for some reason they still haven't gotten a vaccine, or maybe they changed their mind and now they're ready to get one, please go to our website at vermonthealth.org, and you will find a section there on homebound, and there will be a phone number there that you can call to arrange for your homebound visit.
I think the governor, Tracy, yesterday talked about testing for students in schools and also for summer camps. What's the thinking behind that?
Yes, testing will be available for summer camps. All of the details of that aren't worked out yet. It won't be required on camp. I think there will be requirements for kids who are coming from out of state to be able to show that they're negative. But I don't want to speak too much to that. I think I would want to check in on the latest guidance. But if you do register for a camp, particularly a residential camp, there should be information, especially if you're coming from out of state, on testing as you come into the state. For regular day camps,
Some testing will be available possibly for unvaccinated kids, but I can't speak to all the details on how that will work right now. We can get that answer for you and hopefully speak to that some more next week, or I can get that information so you can put it up.
That'd be great. We'd appreciate that. You know, the other thing we're seeing, Tracy, is a number of colleges in Vermont saying to their students, hey, if you want to come back in the fall, you need to be vaccinated. Does this strike you as a good approach?
I don't want to speak to the college decision on whether or not they require it. I can say that we would encourage any approach that increases vaccination on a college campus. Colleges do already require some vaccinations, and so this wouldn't be a new concept. And given the congregate living nature of people going to college, I can certainly understand where their concerns are around the risk. The health department has the same concerns, and we would support whatever colleges want to do to make their students safer. Ultimately, that will be a college decision, but we meet with the colleges every week, and we certainly support their thinking on this and whatever choice they make to keep their student population safe. And as far as I know, most students are very pro-vaccine and are looking to get vaccinated. So my hope is that this isn't a significant obstacle and that most people, regardless of this requirement, are really interested in being vaccinated and keeping their campuses safe.
You know, Tracy, we've just got a few minutes left, but the governor has talked about, and certainly Commissioner Levine has talked about, you know, we're almost there. The vaccination efforts are going well. The state has really got this situation pretty much under control, but this is not the time to let up on it. People still have to stay focused and practice good health practices. What do you see as the biggest obstacle to Vermont achieving its vaccination goals at this point in the coming weeks?
Well, we are doing really well. We're at 69%, a little over 69% for first dose and 50% for two dose. So we're doing very well. In terms of obstacles, I would say it's really just us as a state continuing to try to get the vaccine to people who want it and who may not have gotten it yet, really encouraging people to continue to think about and work on getting vaccinated. For those who are on the fence, you know, do some research, talk to folks, talk to others who've been vaccinated if you're nervous about side effects, and see if you can get the answers you need. Go to the Department of Health website. We have a lot of frequently asked questions that might put your mind at ease. But I think the obstacle really is just needing people to get vaccinated. And that's just not, you know, the Vermont population's obstacle. That's our work together. And the other challenge, of course, is that we'd love to see people continuing to wear masks in crowded areas while we get to that place. And that's, you know, that gets harder to do, obviously, as time goes on. But I'm seeing here in Vermont that people are continuing to mask up. They're aware of this. They want to get past this finish line as well, or as close to the finish line as we can get. And so I feel like we are really all pulling together. I'm really feeling that in the air. And I feel very positive about going into the summer.
That's good news. We'll be following many of these issues in the weeks and months ahead. Many thanks to Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. Take care.